I'm here. Before we start the show, I just want to make a quick request to rate us, follow us, and subscribe to Making Contact on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Making contact.
I'm Jessica Partnow, your guest host for this week. And as your guest host, I'm bringing you a special guest episode from our podcast partners at In Confianza.
So I'm Liz Rebecca Alarcón. I am saying hello from sunny Miami, Florida.
Liz is the host of this episode, and she loves Miami. Like, loves Miami. Personally, I don't know Florida super well. I don't know Miami well. And what I do know is a little bit dicey. So I had to ask Liz, like, what is it about Miami?
It's a city of multiple truths, multiple simultaneous, cognitively dissonant realities in one. So yes, Florida men exist. And yes, we are unfortunately leading the way in some of the worst things happening in our country right now. And also, Miami-Dade County specifically is a minority majority city. Everyone in power, from a government to thriving businesses to tourism and through healthcare, is Latino. We lead the country in small business growth. We are now a leading ecosystem for startups and tech. So all of that is also the Miami story. But I think when I even take it to the personal, this is the first time I speak English today. So it really is the headquarters of Latin America, because people will speak to you in Spanish first. I value that so much because it is very important for me, for my daughter to grow up with that culture. And I also can see how it is not reality, because it is a thriving, multicultural, salad bowl, truly. And it is what I think the United States will look like in the next decades. So it's a very empowering place to live, where you can rep your culture, not just from Latin America, but from anywhere that you come from proudly, and it's embraced. And I think that that's really, really beautiful about my community.
Okay. That sounds a lot better than alligators and Florida man. So let's go ahead and take a listen to this episode. This is Miami's Battle Over Bilingual from Pulso on the In Confianza podcast.
The gleaming towers of Miami Beach, set against the dazzling blue of the sea, are a scenic signpost for seekers of fun and sun.
Miami in the 1950s, sunny, romantic, and white. Really white. Back then, 85% of Miami was white, about 15% black, and there were almost no Latinos. Very different from the city of today I know and love. You all have heard me talk often about what Miami looks and sounds like. It's one of my favorite subjects, honestly. You really do feel like you're at the official HQ of Latin America here. When I enter the building, Sol from Argentina tells my daughter Eva, "Buenos días, mi flaca hermosa." As we're walking the halls, Miss Talia from Cuba tells me, "Se te olvidó la ropa de agua," reminding me I once again forgot Eva's things for water day. As I leave my daughter's classroom, Miss Gina from Colombia, the school admin, says, "Mándale saludos a tu esposo," telling me to say hi to my husband for her. The path for Miami to get to this bilingual haven has been hard. Deep discrimination and mass resistance were what it took to get here. Today's episode is about a decades-long power struggle between those who embraced diversity and those who fought to repress it. This is the story of Miami's battle over bilingualism. You're listening to In Confianza. In the 1950s, Paul George was just a normal kid growing up in Miami. His Miami was vibrant and colorful. Classic Chevy and Ford cars rolled along the streets of pastel Art Deco buildings and palm trees. New suburban neighborhoods that reflected the post-war American dream. Each Sunday, Paul would go to the local Catholic church with his parents. And in the fall of 1959, for the first time, he started to see something different. There were a lot of new faces showing up in mass.
Suddenly there's new people coming in. People with dark hair, kind of greased up, white shirts, standing sometimes throughout the mass, which was not the sort of the American approach.
And it wasn't just at church. Paul started to see these new people working and hanging out around town, usually speaking Spanish.
I remember seeing domino games being played. They could be played right on the edge of a gas station on Southwest A Street, today's famous Calle Ocho.
And even in his own neighborhood.
Suddenly there were Spanish-speaking people living just west of us.
These newcomers were showing up in mass because of something that had happened just a few hundred miles south of Miami, in Cuba.
From his stronghold in the wild Sierra Maestra Mountains, Cuba's Fidel Castro emerged triumphant after guerrilla warfare against the Batista regime. The revolution that began with Castro a fugitive, practically alone, landing with 82 followers, ended with the flight of dictator Fulgencio Batista and the entry into Havana of rebel forces to be acclaimed by the city.
In 1959, after 6 years of guerrilla warfare, communist leader Fidel Castro succeeded in overthrowing dictator Fulgencio Batista. Castro's revolution garnered popular support by promising land reform, economic equality, and an end to U.S. influence in Cuban affairs. But once in power, the new regime began violently repressing any dissent by jailing political opponents and appropriating private property and businesses of everyday citizens.
Everything changed. All the rights and all the civil liberties that we enjoy in this country disappeared. No freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of anything.
This is Eduardo Padrón, the former president of the largest Latino-serving institution of higher learning, Miami-Dade College, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But in 1959, he was just a 15-year-old teenager living in Cuba.
My parents were very horrified of the idea that we would be indoctrinated into a Marxist system.
So Eduardo's parents made a brutal choice. They decided to send him and his brother by themselves to the United States.
My parents told my brother and I not to worry, not to cry, that in just a few months we would be back and we will be reunited.
Eduardo became part of a first wave of Cuban refugees.
I didn't know the English language, didn't have any money, only what I was wearing. No friends or families in the United States.
These early refugees were referred to as the Golden Exiles. Many were well-off, educated, and financially stable. These were people who had the means to relocate to a new home.
These were not economic refugees. These were political refugees. Political in the sense that there was a political system that they couldn't survive in. And they thought that they were going back. Those Cubans felt that the revolution will not last.
Cuba had been through multiple revolutions in the previous decades, and everyone assumed this regime would also be temporary, and that after a few months or years, they would all go back home. Paul George, who we heard from earlier, he's now a Miami historian who documented this era of change in Florida and in Cuba as well.
So they're coming over here on a, as they saw it, a temporary basis. But look, you got to make a living, you got to eat. So even though it was a refugee status or an exile status, these people were hard at work. Many of them opened up mom-and-pop businesses, had a following.
By the mid-1960s, Miami had a small but sizable new population of Cuban refugees. They were opening businesses, buying houses, and engaging with the Miami lifestyle in all kinds of ways. But many of them couldn't speak English. And over the next decade, more and more Cubans were trickling into Miami.
You're finding people every day who are coming over. You can't expect them to learn English in a day. You got to assist them in different ways.
In 1973, Miami's progressive mayor, Jack Orr, realized something needed to be done.
And they just said, look, we got to look at the realities of things. About a third of our population now playing Spanish as a first language. And a lot of these people can't really understand things when they go before a clerk to pay their taxes or have to call an ambulance or whatever. We need to reach out to them.
So the city made a practical decision to help the new population operate in Miami.
Bilingual ordinance was passed where you could do business in Spanish with the county, pay your taxes, meet with a zoning official, or whatever it was.
Translators adapted thousands of pages of English public documents into Spanish and vice versa each year. Interpreters' voices echoed at meetings and conferences. Radio stations even aired Spanish public service announcements.
And that was very well received by the Latino Hispanic community.
Things were working, but slowly, as more Cubans started trickling into Miami, tensions were rising among the local white community.
I saw signs that said, no Cubans, no Jews, no pets. And at the beginning, I couldn't understand whether that was a joke or whether that was something else.
Growing up, Eduardo faced discrimination on a daily basis. And in 1974, he decided to finally do something about it.
From very early on, I became an activist. I became very involved in spite of my youth because I felt that was wrong. That's not the kind of America that I wanted to live on.
Eduardo decided to take the fight against discrimination into his own hands.
And that's when some of us had the idea of creating the Spanish American League Against Discrimination. The short for that is SALAD.
SALAD aimed to help the local Cuban communities fight the anti-Latino discrimination they saw on a daily basis. And as the decade ended, things were about to get worse. Much, much worse. In the early 1980s, something happened that completely shook the relationship between the Cuban community and American-born locals that changed the landscape of language in Miami. This when we come back.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
For years, the Cuban population in Miami had been growing, and with it, tensions from some of the white community. But in 1980, it was about to get a lot worse. On April 1st, a group of six Cubans seeking asylum crashed a bus through the gates of the Peruvian embassy, desperately hoping for a way to escape. The Peruvian government refused to return the asylum seekers to Cuban authorities.
So Castro said, okay, if that's what you want, I'm going to empty my jails, my mental hospitals, and anybody who wants to go can go over to the Peruvian embassy.
Within just a matter of days, 10,000 more Cubans had come to the embassy looking for their own way out of the country. And Castro announced that anyone who wanted to leave could go through the port of Mariel. The doors were now open. Families who'd already made the journey to the U.S. scrambled to pick up their relatives. This event became known as the Mariel boat lift.
Since last month, 25,000 refugees from Castro's Cuba have come to America.
Between midnight and noon today, 23 boats filled with over 800 Cubans reached Key West, Florida. U.S. Marines are now on duty at Key West to keep order among the restless refugees waiting resettlement in the United States.
Over the course of several months, thousands of boats of all shapes and sizes made the journey to a packed and chaotic Mariel Harbor. An estimated 125,000 Cubans left their Caribbean nation for the United States. U.S. immigration policy dictated that any Cuban who arrived on U.S. shores could stay. This was known as wet foot, dry foot policy. But welcoming this many people was a huge challenge. Thousands of refugees were processed in churches, military bases, and the Miami Dome. They were then moved to larger compounds to reunite with relatives and access social services. You all can imagine the influx seriously strained local resources and, of course, heightened tensions. The refugees were people from all walks of life, but the U.S. media went wild with the idea that the whole boat lift was full of Castro's criminals, mental patients, and quote-unquote undesirables.
These are sociopaths. They're not good citizens. They have no potential to be good citizens. And they proudly display the time that they've spent in Cuban jails.
While it was true that there were some criminals and some mental patients among the refugees, it was a relatively small percentage, just around 10%, compared to the thousands of everyday citizens simply looking for freedom. But the fear took hold and started a new wave of backlash against the Cuban community. By the early 1980s, the population of Miami-Dade County was more than 40% Latino, compared to around 10% in the 1960s. As the Cuban influence grew, Miami's white population was starting to feel alienated from their Latino neighbors and threatened with the loss of the community they had known. All this combined with an incredibly tumultuous and violent period known as the Cocaine Wars, Then the stage was set for a new chapter in Miami's relationship with the Spanish language. Some white Miamians became increasingly hostile to Spanish speakers.
They were not very different from some of the things you hear today, to be honest with you.
A Miami resident named Emmy Schaefer spearheaded a campaign aimed at stopping bilingualism in Miami. Several years earlier, she had founded an organization called Citizens of Dade United. The group was vehemently anti-bilingual, and their sole purpose was to overturn the 1973 ordinance. The fear and controversy over the Mariel boat lift was just what she needed to get energy behind this movement.
They took advantage of the anger and the disconnect that a lot of people had. Like, where's this place going? What role do I have in this place? Will I have a job tomorrow?
The group gathered volunteers and set out on a campaign to get a new voter referendum on the ballot, one that would reverse the bilingual ordinance. They claimed it was an initiative to unite Dade County, but the thousands of Spanish speakers felt very differently. Here's Emmy Schaefer in a press conference.
It doesn't mean that all Spanish people have to get on a boat and go back to Cuba. It does not mean I hate. The petition means one thing: to eliminate expenditure and to bring two communities together, to work together.
It was a grassroots campaign. They knocked on doors. They handed out brochures. They had campaign gatherings. They encouraged people to get to the polls.
The odd thing was that Emmy Schaefer was herself an immigrant. Schaefer was born in Russia before coming to the U.S. later in life. She herself was bilingual, although she didn't speak Spanish. Schaefer and Citizens of Dade United held gatherings and rallies where you would see people waving American flags, holding signs that said, I love English, and shouting anti-immigrant sentiments.
When I go to Spain, I speak Spanish. When I go to France, I speak French, and I'm going to Germany next year, and I'm learning German.
This is ridiculous. It is another way to spend more money. That's another way to use up more tax dollars.
Citizens of Dade United wanted to put a new referendum in front of voters that would repeal the bilingual ordinance passed 7 years ago. To do this, they collected tens of thousands of petitions from around the county. Latino organizations sued, saying it would be discriminatory and unconstitutional to overturn the bilingual ordinance.
Suit filed by the United Cuban American Association seeks to halt a petition drive by Citizens for Dade United to repeal a resolution adopted in 1973, which declared Dade County officially bilingual in English and Spanish.
We're trying to stop what we consider an unconstitutional petition.
Citizens of Dade United kept campaigning, collected signatures, and eventually the English-only movement succeeded. In a few months, the official language of Miami-Dade County would be up for a vote. The air was tense.
The bilingual repeal issue may decide whether former Mayor Jack Orr's 1973 Welcome and Act of Friendship is still valid in 1980.
And then the time came to vote.
About 60% voted for repeal.
Emmy Schaefer and her supporters opened their champagne shortly after 9 p.m. last night to celebrate the passage of their anti-bilingual ordinance.
As far as the ordinance concerned, this is a one step forward. Everyone should put 100% effort so that we can communicate instead of making this community farther and farther apart.
And that was not well taken by the Cuban community. A lot of people had not realized up to that point the antagonism, the dislike, the fear that a lot of people had.
There was a feeling of betrayal on the part of the Cubans.
The new law prohibited county officials from using any language but English and from fostering any culture other than that of the United States. It prohibited county funds from translating any documents into Spanish, Creole, or other languages used by Miamians. The ordinance was so restrictive that even zoo signs identifying an animal's name in Latin violated the law and had to be taken down.
It restricts you. It can cause a loss. It could be a monetary loss. It could be a medical loss. It's just unreasonable. It's crazy.
Even outside of government, the new ordinance was having an effect. Many employers mistakenly believed that it applied to them as well. There were accounts of supermarket employees being suspended for speaking Spanish to fellow employees. Children complained that they were forbidden to speak Spanish in school hallways and on school buses. Even hospitals weren't immune. An 18-year-old clause in a hospital handbook requiring employees to speak English during the workday was used for the first time to prohibit employees from speaking a foreign language to non-English speaking patients and to each other. Eduardo and his colleagues at SALAD were shocked. They needed to find a way to fight back against these attacks. And Eduardo realized that there was one clear reason why such a damaging law was able to pass.
We did not have enough Cubans, Latinos registered to vote. In order to have a vote, you needed to register. In order to register, you needed to be an American citizen.
But even years after the Cuban Revolution, many refugees had still retained this transitory mentality, not wanting to nationalize because they were still hoping to go home one day. SALAD wanted to convince Cuban residents that voting was the only way to start getting fair treatment in their new home.
So we started several campaigns. We had the help of radio stations and television stations.
They coined the phrase,
"Vota para que te respeten." It meant vote so you can get respect.
And SALAD was not alone in this fight. Miami's Spanish-speaking population was growing, and so was opposition to the English-only ordinance. Things were getting heated. Jorge Valdez, a county councilman, proposed that the law be repealed. He was met by angry protests with signs threatening to hang council members. Finally, the federal government came in and ruled that Miami's lack of multilingual signage on its public transportation systems was a violation of citizens' civil rights. The Dade County Commission decided to allow certain exceptions for promoting tourism, providing medical and emergency services, and serving the elderly and handicapped. A slightly more relaxed version of the law was grudgingly put into place by the county to avoid federal defunding, but educational information was still restricted to English. Spanish directional signs in the county hospital had to be removed, fire prevention information, neonatal care literature, bus schedules. None of these could be printed in Spanish. In a particularly dramatic case, the clerk of courts actually banned marriages conducted in languages other than English.
A lot of people really wanted to hear, "I love you, you are married, you can kiss each other" in Spanish. It has so much more meaning.
So Eduardo's partner at SALAD, Osvaldo Soto, set up a tent in a parking lot of Little Havana and offered free Spanish language marriages in his open-air chapel. As the 80s rolled into the 90s, Miami continued changing. The Latino and Cuban and Haitian populations grew and began to wield more influence and power.
About 60% plus of the county was Spanish as a first language, as opposed to what had been back in 74, when it was about a third. So it had almost doubled.
By this point, the only thing keeping the unpopular English-only ordinance in place was a white-dominated county commission. But that, too, was about to change.
Judge Donald Graham had ruled back in the early 90s in favor of district representation on the county commission. So you live in a certain neighborhood, you have a certain commissioner who represents you.
The courts decided the county commission needed to be elected by the citizens in each district. This meant that Latino or Black Miamians could vote in someone from their community to represent them. This drastically changed the makeup of the commission. As of 1993, for the first time, the Miami-Dade County Commission was made up of majority Black and Latino commissioners. To top it off, only a few years earlier, it came to light that John Tanton, the leader of a group called U.S. English, had made horribly racist remarks which put a mark on the whole movement. With the English-only movement on the brink, the stage was now set for a new showdown to decide Miami's official language.
Contentious? Yeah, it was contentious.
Lawyer Gregory Sams remembers the county commission meeting on May 18th, 1993.
It was packed. There were news cameras there. It was going to change the face of the town.
Gregory was one of the lawyers who would address the commission and argue against the English-only ordinance.
It was feeling like Miami. There were different groups. You had your groups of Anglos sitting in one section, a whole bunch of people from the community that was all for it. I signed up to speak against the English-only ordinance because I just felt that this didn't make sense as to who we are and where we wanted to go.
Both sides gave impassioned speeches during the six-hour meeting that was conducted under bomb threat.
Are you really what the Statue of Liberty says you are? Are you really what the Constitution says you are? Well, now's the time to prove that. You know, it was New Miami versus old. The future versus the past. That's what it was.
The decision from the 13-member commission was unanimous. English only was dead. Inside the courtroom, the Cuban community celebrated. It was a long-fought victory, one that people like Eduardo Padrón wanted the whole city to recognize. The mood outside the courtroom wasn't as celebratory, though. Remnants of the English-only protesters stood outside chanting, "God bless America." And the English-only rhetoric is one we're still hearing today. 30 years after this victory, Miami is unquestionably a bilingual city. But the fight over the right to speak our language and be who we are is as alive as ever. Here in Florida, the right to learn our full Black history and learn the triumphs of our Latino heroes is being banned by state government. Moves to eliminate initiatives that incentivize equal access to higher education and diversity initiatives across industries are also being banned. As the Latino population of the United States continues to grow, the fight for bilingual representation is still a battle worth fighting for. As Eduardo Padrón says, the work to attain language recognition was more than just cultural identity. It actually reflected what we want for everyone who lives in this country.
After listening to this story, I really wanted to ask Liz what she thinks the rest of the country can learn from Miami.
Knowing your history is so important because we stand on the shoulders of so many brave and courageous people that came before us that started to fight these battles that we somehow still find ourselves fighting. Fighting for pluralism and for multilingualism and for diversity is the American way. It is very much baked in how the founders of our country imagined our country. You know, for the vast majority of our history, the government did not designate an official language to this country. And I would love to believe that that was intentional, precisely because our rights as individuals come from being good citizens and from what we contribute and not from any sort of pure lineage or any sort of legacy beyond what we make ourselves when we come here. And I think that lesson is important to remind ourselves because sometimes we can forget that that is the true American dream. Those are true American values. That is the spirit and the values that we were founded on. And it's a fight worth continuing to press on because to me, it's the American way.
Hmm. I love that. Yeah. Thank you so much. Just such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Here. Thank you all for amplifying our work. Latino history is U.S. history.
Today's guest episode of In Confianza was hosted by Liz Rebecca Alarcón. It was produced, audio engineered, scored, and mixed by Charlie Garcia with editing by Mark Pagan. You can find Pulso on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, and at projectpulso.org. Here at Making Contact, I'm your guest host for the week, Jessica Partnow. Gina Chung is our executive director, Jeff Emptman engineers our show, and Lissa Dionarin does our digital marketing. You can find us on the web at focmedia.org. And that's all for Making Contact this week.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.